Our speaker today is Jack Rowe, who some of you know. Jack was a graduate student in Languages and Cultures of Asia from 2005 to 2007, and he now works for the Department of Defense and lives in Washington, D.C. He received a fellowship from the DOD to return to Madison this year to study the Kazakh language. And his research in LCA is focused on Sufism in Central Asia in the 19th and 20th centuries. And Jack has made several recent trips to Central Asia, including a three-week journey in the Fergana Valley in May 2011. And that will be the focus of his presentation today, a three-week slog in the 21st century Fergana Valley. Jack told me before, in case anyone was wondering, he had put that word slog in there just to signal that this is not going to be kind of a typical heavy-handed academic talk, but an enjoyable presentation of his field research and his findings there. So please join me in welcoming Jack Rowe.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak here at the Creek Lecture Series today. I've seen a lot of eminent scholars present presentations on their groundbreaking research here. Unfortunately, I won't maintain that tradition today. Basically, what I want to do today is give you a travelogue of my recent trip in the Fergana Valley and talk about some of the cultural complexity that you can see in the contemporary Fergana Valley today. First thing I should say is my disclaimer. I do work for the Department of Defense, but everything that follows hereafter is solely my opinion and should not be construed to represent the official policy of DOD or President Obama or Panetta as the Secretary of Defense, et cetera, et cetera. So all faults to follow hereafter are mine alone. This is not meant to be a scholarly presentation, as I said, but hopefully it will give you a taste of what life is like in the Fergana Valley presently. And just a little about the title, besides, you know, the signal that this is not a scholarly presentation by putting the word slog in there, it is a slog to travel through the Fergana Valley, even in the 21st century. If you want to travel to all three parts of the Fergana Valley, you have to have three visas. Depending on which route you take, you have to have three multiple entry visas. Crossing a border usually consists of going through several layers of border control on one side, walking 50 yards to the next side of the border through no man's land, going through their border control, and then hoping there's a taxi on the other side of the border. So, and you have to switch the SIM cards in your cell phone in each part of the valley, which is insane because it's a very compact area. Just to give you a little more short introductory material on myself so you may understand my perspective on the issues I'm going to be talking about. I'm originally from Southeast Idaho, a very small town of 800 people or so, a village rather. In a very rural area, I grew up spending time on farms, working on farm and in rural areas. So going to Central Asia for me feels home in a way. The rural culture, though it's different. There's many similarities. Also, the geography and the climate of Central Asia, and particularly the Fergana Valley, are very reminiscent of Intermountain West. In fact, I will come home excitedly with a camera full of 1,000 pictures to show my wife. Wow, look at this, and she'll be like, no, that just looks like Idaho, and doesn't really want to look at the pictures. But as a young man, I served as an LDS missionary in India, and that experience got me interested in Islam. And I decided when I got home that I would spend, you know, my career path would be studying Islam in an academic academic discipline. And to that end, I went to the University of Arizona and did a master's there in the Near East Studies program, focusing on Turkish language, Ottoman Empire, Turkey, and Islam. And during that experience, I actually went and studied in Istanbul for a summer and became very interested in not just the Turks, but Turkic people in general in Central Asia, as well as Islamic mysticism or Sufism. And so in 2005, as Jennifer mentioned, I came here to work on a PhD with Ulay Shamloglu in the Languages and Cultures of Asia department to work on Turkic peoples and cultures of Central Asia, and as well as Islamic mysticism. After a few years, I thought, you know, maybe I should grow up and get a job and, you know, provide for my family. And so I came across this opportunity where the National Defense Intelligence College, which is part of DOD, was offering a scholarship. I applied and was lucky enough to get it. I went there and did an MS and then was given a job afterwards at DOD, and I've been there for the last 4 years. And I wrote my MS there on state failure, militant Islam, and stability in the Fergana Valley, and actually wrote it under the guide of Dr. Daniel Burkhart, who actually delivered a presentation here maybe a month ago or so. He's actually a UW alum, so happy coincidence brought us together. And he helped me get a fellowship to go out and do some research in the Fergana Valley as part of my MS. And before I went to the Fergana Valley, I had all these notions of what it was going to look like. I'd been reading all these books like Ahmad Rashid's Jihad, the Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia, and the Center for Preventive Action had put out this report called Calming the Fergana Valley, Development and Dialogue in the Heart of Central Asia. And these works are very focused on the Islamic Jihad Union and the Islamic movement in Uzbekistan, Hizb ut-Tahrir, militant Islamic organizations, as well as inter-ethnic violence and resource conflict. And so I had this idea, the Fergana Valley is going to be this sort of scary, heavily conservative, sort of Taliban-light region. And when I actually went there, I thought, well, this is really different. I don't want to tell you that there are no issues there. Obviously, there are, or there wouldn't have been the large-scale interethnic violence that happened in April of 2010, just last year. But in reality, the Fergana Valley is a very complex place. It's not just a bundle of negative issues or a breeding ground for militant Islam or interethnic conflict. It's very complex in terms of culture, and that's what I want to talk about today. The first time I went there, I had these ideas about, you know, it being a very conservative Islamic place. And I showed up, and I see young women walking around with flower print headscarves and you know, tight-fitting jeans and very hip clothing, walking around with their boyfriends, you know, in unaccompanied all over town. Very much like, it reminded me of Turkey very much. And so I thought, well, this place is really different than what I've led to believe it's like. I also happened to eat at a McDonald's in the city of Andijan. That wasn't a real McDonald's. Somebody had just taken McDonald's logo and blown it up billboard size and slapped it on a house and were serving hamburger inside. But still, it was a McDonald's of a sort. So I came back and I thought, you know, I really need to understand this place better, what's really going on there. And so what I hope today is just to discuss the different layers of culture we can see in the Fergana Valley, from the pre-Islamic to the Islamic to the Russian and then the Soviet period and then, Western influences in the globalized world today. There we go. So, the Fergana Valley has a very long history, part of the ancient Silk Road. It was a part of the Achaemenid Empire in the 6th century BCE, conquered by Alexander. The Han Dynasty at one point laid claim to the Fergana Valley, conquered by Arabs in the 8th century, and then Islam came with the Arabs and shortly thereafter, conquered by Chinggis Khan in the 13th century and the Mongols. It's the birthplace, or the city of Andijan, is the birthplace of Babur, who established the Mughal dynasty in India in the 15th century, conquered by the Uzbeks in the beginning of the 16th century, and then by the Tsarist Empire in the late 19th century. And after the Bolshevik Revolution and the establishment of the USSR in the 20s, between like the mid-20s and mid-30s or so, the Soviets divided up this region, which had always been an integral area here, into three separate Soviet Socialist Republics. So the Uzbek Republic, the Kyrgyz SSR, and the Tajik SSR, which is this neck right here. There are many reasons why they did this, different discussions. The theory I subscribe to most is that put forward by Dr. Francine Hirsch, one of the faculty here at UW-Madison, who talks about the role of local communists and elites and ethnographers in the service of dividing up these republics. The valley today is what it is because it was divided with these borders, which were largely artificial during the Soviet period. But when 1991 comes around and the Soviet Union disintegrates and all these republics become independent, suddenly these borders, which are very, essentially very artificial, become real. And you have situations where, people in Fergana might have family in, in Isfara or something, and all of a sudden they can't go there without a visa or a passport or going through borders. The valley is not very large. It's approximately 300 kilometers long, and at its widest point is 70 kilometers. but it's one of the most densely populated regions in Central Asia. There are around 11 million people there. The Sirdarya River runs through from Lake Toktogul up there in Kyrgyzstan down through the valley and then out through Karakum Reservoir in Tajikistan and then out through Uzbekistan. It's a heavily cultivated area, very lots of different crops grown there, particularly cotton, and traditionally is one of the more religiously conservative areas in Central Asia. And I'm roughly going to follow the chronology in this presentation that I followed when I went to the valley. So I'll start out in Namangan, go to Andijan, down to Fergana, Kokand, this is all in Uzbekistan, across the border down into Hojand in Tajikistan. I may mention something about Istarafshan here, but I'll talk mostly about Isfara, which is a city here in far west eastern Tajikistan, and then the Voruch Enclave, which is a little bit of Tajik territory within Kyrgyzstan. So very interesting, there you see these little enclaves here. Then I'll move on to Batken in southern Kyrgyzstan, over to Isfana in southern Kyrgyzstan, up through to Osh, and then to a city here, which is not on this map, called Gulcha, which is around 30 kilometers from the Chinese border, I believe. There we go. All right. So I go to Namangan, and I hadn't previously visited Namangan before. My first trip, I went to Andijan, Kokand, and Fergana, and didn't have much time to go up to Namangan, which is a different way to travel up into the northern valley. Namangan is famous for being a very conservative religious city. In the 90s, a group calling itself Adalet, or Justice in Uzbek, established a militant Islamist group established their own form of government over the city of Namangan and maybe some of the outlying regions in the chaos that, you know, followed the breakup of the Soviet Union. This happened in late 1991. By early 92, this group was essentially run out of the valley. Some of its leading lights, like Tahir Yoldashev and Juman Namangani, takes his name from Namangan, established the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan in Tajikistan during the civil war there in the 90s. So it has this bad reputation of this breeding ground of these militants. And a colleague and I, who's pictured here, I asked him if I could show his picture today, and he kind of grimaced because he didn't like this picture of himself. But that's, you know, either here or there. He can't stop me now. We showed up in Namangan, and we're like, what's this place going to be like? We've heard all the stories. The first thing we did was go to the downtown, the major park there. And then there's a Luna Park, a sort of carnival area nearby. And I saw these young women, some of them in traditional dress, wandering around the park, and I sort of surreptitiously tried to snap a picture of them because I'm like, this is a great National Geographic moment. Look at these girls with their traditional dress and what. And they saw me, and they just, a gaggle of them just swooped down on us. And I'm like, oh no, what are they going to tell us why are you taking our picture? And they demanded that we take their picture, and they wanted to take our picture as well. And one of them actually pulled out a cell phone and took our picture. So, not that a cell phone is the ultimate marker of modernity, but it's an interesting thing to have your picture taken by some young kids in Namangan with a cell phone. And we sort of followed this pattern, and we went to amusement parks and parks in Namangan, in Andijan, and Fergana. The school semester was just, or the school period had just ended, so there were plenty of kids out. And this is actually, this is an attraction, I don't know what it's called, probably Death Trap should be the name of it, in Andijan. And I convinced my reticent colleague here to get on this thing with me, and we probably shouldn't have done it. I'm worried about carnival equipment maintenance in this country, I don't know about in foreign countries. But we survived the riot, and that broke the ice. A lot of teenage kids came up to us and were like, oh, that was great, you rode this thing. And they were very interested in talking with us about American culture, and they all seemed to be very clued into the hip-hop scene, and I don't know my contemporary music too much, but they all liked 50 Cent a lot. That was the name. That's the name they mentioned quite a bit.
What were you speaking to them?
Uzbek and Russian, depending on the conversation. My Russian's not that good, but my colleague there speaks pretty good Russian, so he was carrying that end of the load. The bazaar in Namangan, interesting place, famous for selling beshik cradles. As we wandered around the bazaar, we were constantly asked, "Откуда вы? Из Франции? Из Германии?" Like, we apparently looked like Europeans, because we were constantly asked if we were French or German, and the conversation would always go this way: "Откуда вы?" And we'd say, "США, USA," and they would go, "Ah, America," and then that would immediately be followed by, Barack Obama or Gubernator Schwarzenegger? And so we had a lot of good conversations about, and actually the Schwarzenegger scandal broke while we were there in Tajikistan with Arnold, you know, fathering the child out of wedlock and, you know, leaving his wife and whatnot. And so it was funny because at first we're like, you know, Schwarzenegger, we talk about old movies, and then it was like, oh yeah, Schwarzenegger, there's that whole scandal, and they're like, yeah, I don't know if he can be the governor anymore. So there, that was an interesting moment there. The bazaars all over Central Asia are completely full of Chinese goods. I am willing to bet my eye teeth that this comes from China, although obviously it's in English here, and not too bad English for that matter either. I don't know what the message of the shirt's supposed to be exactly. It says, this is my Glock, there are many like it, but this one is mine. I don't know. I just thought it was a good picture, so I took it. This guy here, a blacksmith, was working, and once again I was trying to snap the National Geographic picture from behind a pillar or something, then he saw me and then turned around and smiled and held his position, so I took his picture. One of the most interesting things that happened in the bazaar, and I believe this was in Andijan, is we were trying to buy movies, and at one point there were some kids selling movies, probably 15 years or older, so I was looking for some Soviet movies, and they did not understand like a syllable of Russian. I mean, they didn't say like "Я не понимаю по-русски," nothing. They just stood like deers in the headlights and shook their heads. And I had to ask them in Uzbek, do you guys not know any Russian? I think at one point, one of them actually said in English, we don't know Russian, or I don't know Russian. So what a strange phenomenon that is to be in a former republic of the Soviet Union and to see this cultural shift where people aren't even learning Russian anymore. Now, how widespread that is, I don't know, but it was a very interesting thing to me to see. I also like to visit as many religious institutions in Central Asia when I can. This is a very famous madrasa, the Mullah Kyrgyz Madrasa there in Namangan, and I believe actually Tahir Yildishev, one of the founders of IMU, studied here at one point. The keeper of the madrasa was very wary, didn't really, he was pleasant enough, but didn't exactly want us in there, and basically in the end said, I can't let you wander around unless you go clear it with the local religious authorities at the hakimiyat, the oblast level. And we said, well, that sounds like a bureaucratic nightmare that we should avoid. So instead we walked down the street to the Jami Masjid here, the Friday mosque, and we didn't plan it this way. We just happened to get there at the time of afternoon prayer, which is not a good thing to do usually. And I try to avoid that, but you don't hear azan, generally, the call to prayer in Central Asia, not in Uzbekistan especially. So sometimes you just don't know unless you're, you know, keeping a good watch on things. So we showed up. People were eyeing us very warily, but then I went up and spoke some Uzbek, you know, hi, how are you doing, Yakshmises, how are things going? And suddenly everybody became very friendly, and pretty soon they were back slapping us and saying, oh, I studied English at one point, and I love reading Faulkner, who knows what they were talking about, you know, American and British literature and whatnot, and we were old pals after a while. So this notion that Namangan's this sort of scary, backward place, and that the Fergana Valley in general is just, you know, frozen in time, and there's no intercourse with the outside world, and it's like the you know, the 17th century or something, are very misleading. This was a picture of a sign I took around walking around at night in Namangan. I actually saw lots of mixed-sex couples walking around unchaperoned at night by themselves. And the sign says, family stability is the basis of national stability or prosperity, depending on how you translate it, Farvanlik. And actually, we were driving around with a taxi driver that night in Namangan, and I don't even know how we brought up the subject, like, are there dance clubs here? And the guy's like, oh, yeah, and starts naming off all these places. He also gave us a long list of prices for prostitutes as well. And so Namangan, a much more world-wise city, I guess, than stories have led me to believe. Next, we moved on to Fergana. When we got to Fergana, we heard that the Neftchi, the local team, which is a higher, I believe, one of the top-ranked soccer teams in Uzbekistan was playing. We said, well, we got to go see this, especially when we heard, well, there might be hooligan there. And we're like, oh, well, we got to go, you know, if there's going to be hooliganis, you know, running around. So we show up at the place. Out in front of the stadium, there are probably a couple hundred police on the street. And so this, you know, excited us. Oh, there's going to be, you know, like these 17 to 20-year-old guys coming in inebriated and throwing chairs around, you know, because I mean, football matches all over the world are famous for sort of, you know, rowdy fans, and I'd actually never been to one, so I was excited. We went to the ticket counter, and they said, where would you like to sit? You know, the regular section or with the fanatique? And we're like, well, you know, with the fanatics, put us in there, obviously. We show up, the fanatique are these, like, 10 to 13-year-old boys. And this guy, who was like their mascot, and he decided he wanted the two Americans to sit with him, and he showed me his card later. He's like a black belt in several martial arts. He looks thin, but he is made of steel. He essentially picked both of us up by our arms and navigated us to sit right by him, and we didn't argue with him. But the first goal the Neftchi scored, a roar went up from the kids. In the crowd of a couple thousand, at least a third were Militsia. And they let the kids cheer for, 30 seconds, and then they're like, sit down. That's enough of that. And subsequently, every time the kids wanted to cheer, it was like a 10 seconds, and they're like, sit down, that's enough. And actually, they were concerned that, you know, we were in a dangerous place. And several times, a couple of them came up to me and were like, you know, sir, you should put away your camera. You know, who knows, one of these guys is going to, you know, knock your camera out of your hand, or, you know, these fanatique, you know, what are you going to do? But we managed to stay there for the whole game. Interesting experience, and there's me with my fanatique buddies and the Taekwondo master, who I wouldn't mess with. And afterwards, we were actually walking down the street and met some more teenage guys, and we were talking with them. They're like, oh, Americans, we finally got through the whole, you know, Barack Obama, Schwarzenegger, and from America, well, what music do you like? And I was like, well, you know, I don't know what I said to them, but they're like, they seem to think Lady Gaga was great. Moving on to Kokan. Kokan is the old capital of the Kokan Khanate. So you have things like Hurriar Khan's palace here, great place to go see. You also have the Amin Beg Madrasa and essentially what is a necropolis of Kokan Khans from beginning of the 19th century to the present, large cemetery, which is one of the tombs right here. But in addition, what you have in Kokan is KFC. That's Kokan Fried Chicken. And Kokan Fried Chicken has, like the McDonald's aid in Andijan, taken the poster from KFC in this country, blown it up, and stuck it on their place. We were actually riding in the taxi and both, like, you know, I don't know, half asleep or whatever, and I'm like, I just saw a KFC. So we jumped out of the car. We got to see what this place is. We showed up, and if you look at the poster, you can't see it very well, but it has, like, all the things you would get at KFC here, like, you know, coleslaw and mac and cheese and chicken nibblers or whatever. Well, they didn't have any of that when we got in there. They did have free and fried chicken, and pretty good fried chicken at that, too. So that was an interesting experience. Kokan is a very conservative city. Probably the most veiled women or headscarf-wearing women, hijab-wearing women I saw in the Uzbek Fergana Valley was in Kokan. Also, there were signs in our hotel saying, you know, no alcohol is allowed in here, and which doesn't bother me because I don't drink, but my friend was feeling like he was in a dry county in Kansas in the 20s or something. Prohibition was like, well, we got to find a drink somewhere. And we were wandering around the streets, and we happened to come upon this guy who had lived in the U.S., spoke flawless English, and was like, oh, you guys probably want a beer, don't you? Well, let me tell you where to go. And we ended up going to a Chaihana tea house / bar, where there was actually a Manchester United-Chelsea football match being shown. And everybody was actually very happy to see us. The only thing they wanted to know is who we were going to root for. Also, one interesting story here about this place, Amin Beg Madrasa. The guy who actually administers this place, I've met him twice. I met him on my first trip to Fergana, and then I had told my colleague, you know, this guy's here, and there's one thing I remember about him. He loves Donald Rumsfeld. And he's like, what? We get to this place, and it's the same guy. And he shows us around, and he just didn't speak Russian. I don't know, he spoke to me in Uzbek the whole time, and not that my Uzbek's that great, so I'm sort of translating and telling all these stories to my colleague about Donald Rumsfeld. He cares for Donald Rumsfeld a great deal because he feels he has done something good for the Uzbeks and his Uzbek brethren in Afghanistan, freeing from the Taliban and so forth. So there's an interesting experience. But in addition, I was talking to these people outside one of the tombs, and they wanted to know, like, Milatingiz Kandai, what is your nationality? Because in the former Soviet Union and in the Soviet Union, you know, you had your nationality, Tajik, Uzbek, et cetera, in your passport. So it's a very real concept to them. And I had to explain to them, well, you know, I'm an American, but we don't really have that. And they're like, well, what are you? And I'm like, well, you know, my mother's side of the family is all Danish, and then my father's side has, you know, Welsh and English and German. And they're like, whoa, you know, what a mixture you are. My friend's Jewish and Irish, and he's like, don't even bother, you know, tell him it's going to be, they like, that concept is hard enough for Americans, it won't go over well. But after I explained it, they're like, oh yeah, you guys are like that, right? And I'm like, you know, we have African Americans, we have American Indians, we have all these different people in America. And they're like, oh yeah, yeah, I've seen TV, you guys are kind of a mixed bag over there, that makes sense. Next, moving on down to Hojand in northern Tajikistan. Hojand, very different than any place in the Uzbek Fergana Valley. Very affluent, lots of little boutiques, nice restaurants and shops. It was the heart of the ruling caste of the Soviet Tajik SSR for pretty much the whole existence of the Tajik SSR. So that's why it's, you know, sort of a showplace city. We actually met a girl who spoke, once again, flawless English and had goals of going to Harvard and was studying at the university there, and she took us up to see this, which is the second tallest Lenin during the Soviet period in the whole of the Soviet Union. And luckily we saw it, because you can see here scaffolding, they actually moved it to somewhere outside the city just a few weeks after we saw it. But just down from Lenin, there's a tennis court, and there was a breakdance competition going on that night. We said, well, we can't pass up this opportunity. We went to see a soccer match in Fergana, we better go see the breakdance competition. So we go to this thing, completely different scene than what we saw in Uzbekistan. No police there, I think two showed up, looked in the door and left. Families, all kinds of people coming to see this thing. And there were girls participating as one of the breakdance teams. Now, they weren't very good. I'm sorry, I don't want to, you know, not a misogynist, but their dancing was not as good as the male teams. I don't know why. Breakdance, I don't know anything about it, but it was amazing that there are women there participating in this thing. I don't think you would see that in Uzbekistan. And the music, they were breakdance. I mean, that doesn't sound very hip and modern, but the music they were actually playing was, you know, even things that a fogey like me recognized as being as contemporary stuff. So very interesting scene there, and this is actually someone spinning on his head. I had, you know, film and lots of pictures of breakdancing, but I think I would bore you with that. And in my rush to do my slides, I think I actually left one out. Ah, well. Next, we went to a place called the Arbab Cultural Palace, which is the headquarters of a collective farm, former collective farm, in Tajikistan, just outside of Hojand. It's modeled on the Peterhof in St. Petersburg, so it's this massive building. It has this huge processional avenue leading up to it with a statue of Lenin. You still see lots of Lenins in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, which you will not see in Uzbekistan. They're much more comfortable, I think, with their Soviet heritage than the Uzbeks are. This place has enormous fountains in the shape of cotton bowls, because cotton is the preeminent crop there. And inside the Arbab is all these great socialist realist paintings and sculpture and displays about life on the collective farm. I believe it was the largest collective farm in Central Asia before it was shut down. So I don't really have anything great to say about this other than there's this enormous place with all this great art. I believe this guy was a hero of the Soviet Union, and I thought this painting was excellent. I love socialist realist art. But there was not a soul there. I mean, there was the caretaker, and this thing's enormous. It was actually the place where President Rahmon, the current president of Tajikistan, I believe he was installed as president there in 96 during the Tajik Civil War. And it actually is where the Tajik Soviet, Supreme Soviet, met for the last time and officially declared independence from the USSR in 91. So it's a very famous place, lots of history, but sort of forgotten. It makes me wonder, you know, did I just go on an off day, or is this something that the Tajik youth, while they don't mind allowing, you know, Soviet iconography and whatnot still being around, did they support it at all? This is another interesting city right by Hojand, called Chkalovsk. I apologize for my Russian, my terrible pronunciation. Those consonant clusters get me every time. It's a former closed city. Used to be the heart of the Soviet uranium mining industry, and that's why it was closed until the fall of the Soviet Union, uranium being used for nuclear weapons. It's sort of an alpine, reminds me of a Jackson Hole, Wyoming, if anyone's been there, sort of a resort up in the mountains. And this is actually, well, There you go. I've always got to take a picture of Vladimir Ilyich. He's everywhere still. But we have, this is the mining faculty, I believe, of university there. And I don't know how long this Elvis graffiti has been there, but I thought that I should take a picture of it. I'm a fan of taking pictures of graffiti. Very interesting place, full of, you know, little shops and restaurants, and, you know, going from this closed super secret mining area to now sort of a, I wouldn't say a resort, but somewhat sort of like a resort area. Next, we went to the Voruch Enclave, which is that little bit of Tajik territory inside Kyrgyzstan that I pointed out to you. Going up into Voruch, it's a very isolated place. You pass through all these little villages driving up there, and it's between Voruch and Tajikistan proper. There's a chunk of Kyrgyz territory, so you're driving along the road, Tajik village, all of a sudden all these Kyrgyz people are, you know, walking around their village, and you're like, okay. You know, 10 minutes later, Tajik village is again. So very mixed, very interesting place, but very isolated. There's a city called Chorku, about 30,000 people. Probably the strangest place I've ever been in Central Asia. Very much unlike anything I had ever been in the Ferghana Valley. Very much like the stereotypical Ferghana Valley. We arrived there, and our driver said, well, you know, I'd like to go to prayer. Why don't you guys wander around town, and I'll meet you after prayer, and I'll, you know, show you around. So we were wandering around the town, women wearing traditional headscarves, so we had seen in other parts of Central Asia, but they would, when they would see us, they would cross the street. Not only that, they would take the tail of the headscarf and veil themselves with it. I've never seen the like of that in Central Asia, and there was a very tense feeling in this town that our presence was not wanted. And we were walking down the street, and there was a youth center there, and there were a couple of young guys getting into a scuffle, a couple teenagers. An old man across the street ran over and broke it up, and one of them started pointing at us and saying something in Tajik, and my colleague luckily speaks good Tajik, and I said, well, what's the guy saying? And he said, basically he says, why are you hassling us when we have foreigners walking around our town? So after that, we were both like, yikes. I mean, we're not, obviously, our presence isn't wanted here. And we actually tried to go, there's a famous mosque there from the 14th century, I believe, that has carvings of owls, which is, if you know anything about Islamic iconography and art and decoration, that's haram and not something you would see. And so that's one of the reasons we went all the way out there to see it. People at the mosque were very wary. We met with the imam, who was, you know, pleasant, but he basically said, if you want to see this, go talk to the local head of religious affairs. So we went to this guy, who was a jovial character, larger than life sort of character. But in the end, he said, you know, sorry, guys, I essentially nobody wanted to take the responsibility for letting a couple foreigners look around the mosque. And to contrast that, we went to the city of Istarafshan, which I pointed out on the map before, and we went to a historic mosque there, and where originally people were a little wary, but once we came in and, you know, talked to them and explained, you know, we both studied Islam and, you know, we're interested in Islamic art and whatnot, they were very, very happy to let us in. And actually, they were telling us, you know, this mosque was closed during Soviet times. And I said, well, you know, I'm glad to hear that it's open again. As a religious person and somebody who respects Islam, I'm glad to see it open again. They were very gratified to hear that. After Chorku, we headed up. Actually, the only people in Chorku that were happy to see us were these kids in the river, and they were trying to get us to go swimming. But so the young generation are the hope for Chorku. This is just going up the mountain here. Into further up past Chorku, into essentially on the other side of these, the Turkestan Mountains, you would be in Kyrgyzstan. So it's this interesting little spot. And as we went up the mountain, we got to this. You have the tomb of a Sufi Hoja, a Sufi master, very isolated spot. Our driver stopped, took us to what he told us was a holy spring. He performed a sort of wudu, you know, his ablutions, and then said, well, let's go over, you know, and he asked us to do as well. Then we went over to the tomb, and he said a prayer. Now, this is a wish tree of a type you will see throughout Eurasia. It's has plenty of, you know, pre-Islamic antecedents. I mean, these are either votive offerings of some sort, or, you know, some people say wish cloths, you know, tying a prayer or wish cloth to the tree and sort of so that the saint will remember your wish and use their charisma and barakah on your behalf. And I think what this is, I mean, it's a grave. It's from the 20th century sometime, and I believe it's somebody wanting to be buried by the Hoja. But the fact that there was a sacred spring nearby also has, you know, points back to pre-Islamic Central Asia when more animist sentiment was prominent. One interesting story about this area, as we're driving up this road, up the mountain, we picked up a young teenage boy, or, you know, I don't know, 11 or 12, jumped in the car. He was having a conversation with my colleague and was like, "Where are you guys from?" And my colleague said, "Well, you know, where do you think we're from?" And the kid said, "Are you Chinese?" And we're like, "No, we're not." So obviously very isolated place. Kid had no idea what, you know, Chinese people looked like. Next, we went to a city, Isfara, which is, you know, a fairly good-sized city, 40,000 people. But outside of that, closer to Voruch, the enclave, there's an old Soviet sanitarium. And next to it, there's some bed and breakfast. And this couple, we stayed with them, and they were hilarious. I mean, this place is pretty remote. And we met them, and I'm like, I wonder what they'll think of us and, you know, what their connection with the outside world is. Well, they have satellite TV. And so the first thing when we sit down to eat is, I can't remember her name. I'm sure I have it written down in my journal or something somewhere. The question she really wanted to know is, you know, seriously, she sort of sat us down and was like, "All right, I have a question for you guys. Tell me truly, who is more fabulous, Beyonce or Lady Gaga?" And we were both like, But they watch satellite TV, they watch MTV, all this stuff. They also, they're like, "Oh, I loved Michael Jackson, Madonna back in the day," and we had long conversations about this. But I took my picture with him, and he actually put this, he's like, "Let me put, you know, a baseball cap on, and so I can," he's like, "Do I look like an American now?" But they were great. And here's just a little view of the village going up to the Voruch enclave. Now on Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan, very different, once again, as Uzbekistan is different from Tajikistan, Tajikistan is different from Kyrgyzstan. It's so amazing to see so many cultures, so many people with shared culture and yet so different living so closely together. The city of Botken is very small, you know, around 12,000, sort of a windblown place. It's famous for one thing. Botken province was actually established after the Islamic movement in Uzbekistan led an incursion in a couple into that region. And this is actually a monument in remembrance of the Kyrgyz security forces who were killed there around 50, I believe, in 1999. And then Manas, the national epic of Kyrgyzstan, very, very prominent in the sort of iconography and art of Kyrgyzstan. And this is a park outside of Botken that has these larger than life-size figures of Manas. And we went to a lake nearby and saw some kids swimming, and once again were asked to come dip in the water, so we didn't. Now, I titled this one No Kalashnikovs because you have this once again, I had this image of I am you, and, you know, we're going to get in Botken, it's going to be this scary place. Well, there were more girls wearing short skirts in Botken than probably in Madison. There was a beeline, the Russian cell phone company was having a giveaway on the town square, and they were like, you know, the music was pumping, and like they were giving away SIM cards, I don't know what they were doing. And all the kids in town were there, all the young people. And we needed a new SIM card, as I mentioned, because they don't work over the borders. So we were like, where are we gonna get a SIM card? We went to this, like this dry goods sort of hardware store. And there's this old guy behind the counter, a Kyrgyz guy with his traditional kalpak on, and we're like, "Hey, do you know where we're gonna get a SIM card?" And he's like, "Oh, just a minute." He comes over, you know, there's like bins of bolts and nuts, and he reaches in and pulls out some SIM cards and provides us with a SIM card. He also had a Sega Genesis on his shelf for any video game fans, in mint condition in the box, and I was tempted to buy it, but I didn't do it. Isfana is in far west Kyrgyzstan, southwest of Botken. Takes a while to drive out there, and actually pretty fascinating. If you look at this area, this is closer to Botken. These are the Turkestan Mountains. Looks sort of Switzerland-esque. You know, you hear Kyrgyzstan referred to as the Switzerland of Central Asia. But as you get further west, it suddenly turns into a very Arizona-like landscape. There's these large, multicolored rock formations. Very, very different. Very interesting place. These sort of lonely roads out here, pasture, high desert area. Once again, reminds me of my home in Idaho. We got to Isfana, and we stopped by the Jami Masjid there, and we ran into the Imam Hatib, And he was actually an ethnic Uzbek. There's a large ethnic Uzbek population there in Isfara. And I was actually able to speak with him. And once again, I'm like, how's this guy going to perceive us? On his desk, though, when we went into his office, was an American flag. Turns out this guy had been to conferences and visited Islamic Center openings in New York, in D.C., in Chicago, in Seattle, and, wait for it, Utah and Iowa. And I'm like, Utah? I'm from, you know, Idaho. I'm from just north of there. So we had a great conversation with this guy. And, you know, we actually, for an hour or so, we chatted with him. He showed us around. And once again, he was telling us about various mosques being closed down during the Soviet era, and I'm like, well, you know, I'm glad to hear it's open again. And we actually talked about Islam. You know, it's a subject, obviously, that's near and dear to me, or that I have a passion for. And afterwards, I go out and get in the car, and one of the Imam Khatib's assistants came out and very earnestly. We were talking, because he had actually studied in Turkey, too, as we were talking Turkish and just, you know, talking about Turkey and whatnot. And he came up and said, you have a great respect for Islam. I'm like, yes, I do. And he's like, you seem to know quite a bit about Islam, actually, doctrine and whatnot. And he's like, tell me, why haven't you converted to Islam? And I'm like, well, I don't know what my vocabulary may have failed me there. I think I said something like, you know, who knows why I was born, you know, a Mormon in Idaho and you were born a Muslim in Southwest Kyrgyzstan. You know, may we both find happiness and joy together in the next life, something like that, which he was actually pleased with. So, well, it was a pretty interesting question because I didn't know why he was following me, and then he was just like, tell me, why have you not converted? And I'm like, let's see. Now on to Osh. You've heard about what happened in Osh in 2010. I don't really have much to say other than there's still destruction in Osh. You see this UNHCR, UN High Commission for Refugees. If you would have, you could see in there would have been a tent probably provided by UNHCR. Still destruction. This is the main bazaar in Osh, in central Osh. Not as busy as it used to be. My colleague had been there before, actually studied in Kyrgyzstan and spent time in Osh and said, you know, it's sort of a shadow of its former self. But we saw a lot of rebuilding at the same time, and sort of an odd feeling of tension. But then again, when you talk to people, you know, about what happened, people will all express similar sentiments like, why did this happen? You know, Kyrgyz and Uzbeks are brothers, and this doesn't make any sense. So a very sort of strange picture there. And we actually had a woman stop us, an Uzbek woman. Like, my friend and I were both trying to take, you know, pictures surreptitiously because we don't want to, you know, offend people, but we're like, you know, we're in Osh, we might as well take pictures of, you know, things like this, what happened. And she saw us, and she said, hey, yes, take more pictures. People need to know what happened here. So that was an interesting experience. Last place I'll talk about is Gulcha. That's that little city I mentioned that's near the Chinese border, about 21,000 people there. The kind of place where you have herds of horses walking down the street. You don't even see that in Idaho, really, so that was good. One of the first things I saw when we got to Gulcha is on this very street, I believe, a kid came riding up on his horse, but then like pulled a cell phone out of his pocket and started talking on it, which is a very image that's emblematic of me for what's going on in Central Asia today. You have people using technology, you know, modern technology to text one another, to chat, but then they're, you know, riding the horse and maybe wearing, you know, a traditional Kyrgyz felt hat. And while we were at the bazaar in Gulcha, I happened to glance up on the hill. Gulcha's in the little valley down here. Bazaar is probably down here somewhere. And I saw some domes and things up on the hill, and I said, let's go check this out. Turned out to be a really interesting graveyard. And I put this last because this is sort of emblematic of what I'm trying to get at with the complexity of the culture in Central Asia. One of the first graves we saw was this, and I don't know if you can see it, but there are some ram's horns cemented onto the tomb. And I asked a Kyrgyz driver with us, I'm like, what is the significance of this? And he's like, well, this man was a community leader. He was a wealthy man in his lifetime. You know, this is a symbol of his wealth and prominence, and that's why we put him on our grave. Very interesting. The ram's horn motif is prominent in the sherdaks, the felted patterns that the Kyrgyz makes. It's a very old pre-Islamic symbol of wealth, of fertility, of power. So interesting to see that still present in graveyards. We also, of course, you have your Islamic symbols with your crescent moon and domes and whatnot. At the same time, you have more Soviet or Russian representations where you have the person's face, you know, the image on the stone or in an actual sort of bust here, the way this is. And so for me, this basically sums up what's going on in Fergana today. You have the pre-Islamic culture there. You have the Islamic culture. You have remnants of Russian Tsarist and Soviet influence. You have Western influence. You have people connected with the outside world. You don't have this place frozen in time from the Middle Ages, you know, not aware of what's going on in the rest of the world. And so, you know, hopefully, if anything you get out of this today, you've gotten that Fergana Valley is not this isolated place stuck back in time. And with that, anyone have any questions? Oh, the purpose of my visit is, you know, as part of my job, I'm supposed to be conversant with, you know, world affairs and whatnot. And so I get an opportunity once in a while to go travel. And basically, I just go as a tourist and, you know, wander around, talk to people, look at things or, you know, what are going on. I take away from it what I want to take away from it. I meet people, I see conditions, and, you know, that's essentially what I was doing. Yeah. Nothing exciting. A lot of bureaucratic mess to get out to the travel, but once there, I'm essentially just a tourist. Yes? Yes, sir.
There must be some more fire out there than you saw. Periodically people, I got interested in this area when it first exploded in the 1989 period. Trying to decipher what's going on from Washington. It seems like, you know, it's more mellow and benevolent than perhaps it's the image, but why don't you go to the
Well, I certainly didn't want to give anyone the impression that there's no tension, there's nothing bad out there, and that's part of the reason I put the Osh pictures in there. This stuff is below the surface. As you mentioned, in 89, there was some inter-ethnic violence in the Uzbek Fergana Valley, where Uzbeks were killing Meshetian Turks to a large degree. And then in 1990, you had Kyrgyz and Uzbek violence in Osh and Uzgan and different cities there in southern Kyrgyzstan. And then, of course, the recent outbreak of violence. But you have a real sort of puzzled response to that from the people there. There's obviously something below the surface that makes people want to respond to whatever conditions they're facing with violence, but nobody seems to know exactly what it is. Just in asking people, you know, what do you think about what went on? And they're just like, who knows? Why did this happen? So there's obviously something there, but I mean, if the people on the ground don't know why it happened, then it's pretty hard for someone from, you know, DC to figure out what's going on as well. But I mean, there are obvious issues. I mean, as far as, you know, resources and you know, militant Islam and these things, they're there. They're definitely there. You know, I haven't seen a whole heck of a lot of anything to do with that, but it's obviously there. I don't want anybody to go away with this from thinking that I've come to tell you that the Fergana Valley, everything's hunky dory and there are no problems. But you know, as to why these things happen, it's hard to say.
Just take it more specifically. There are no echoes from Afghanistan?
You know, I haven't heard. No one I've run into in on the strip, specifically in Fergana. I mean, not that I was asking the question, really, but nobody really had anything to say about Afghanistan. And as much as people are connected, you know, culturally with Afghanistan and with the rest of the world through the 24-hour news cycle and whatnot, nobody seemed to mention anything about Afghanistan at all, or any concern about Afghanistan. I'm sure they have concerns. I mean, of course, IMU came from the incursions in 99 and 2000 both started out as, you know, being based in Afghanistan. So they obviously have concerns about that, but average people didn't mention it at all. Question here?
Thank you for the great presentation. As far as I understand,
You know, this is just sort of anecdotal of what I think I saw. It's not very scholarly, and I haven't really sat down to sort of dissect and unpack what I saw and put it into some sort of theoretical framework. But what I saw as far as the outward observance of Islam reminded me of Turkey very much. In other words, a very modern take on Islam. Islam is, I mean, you know, in Turkey you have this situation where a legacy of Kemalism has hampered Islam in many ways, you know. And then you have this recent rise in the popularity of Islam. Anatolian entrepreneurs since the 90s becoming, you know, more economically powerful and, you know, able to express their values in different ways. And so Islam has become not something old, I think, in Turkey, but something that represents modernity, that represents a modern way to face the world. And I think you see that in Central Asia. Like the Imam Khatib I talked to in Isfahan, I mean, his view of Islam is, you know, he studied madrasas in the Middle East, I believe, and actually in the Bukhara madrasa as well in Uzbekistan back in the Soviet time. You know, he knows Persian, he knows Arabic, Uzbek, Kyrgyz, Russian, and who knows what else. But he's very connected to the rest of the world and, you know, has visited this country several times. And so I think, and actually when I would mention to people, you know, we have plenty of Muslims in the United States and we have mosques. And some people were like, really? Wow. You know, but like this guy obviously was like, you know, we didn't talk about that because he's been here and knows all about it. And I think people like him have a view of Islam as this global system. But not so much the Salafist view of we need to reestablish the Ummah of, you know, the Prophet's time, but maybe a modern version of that. And so if I was just going to say anecdotally what I think about Islam in the Fergana Valley, I would say there's plenty of traditional practices. There's religious syncretism to some degree, as you see with, you know, Sufi tombs and whatnot. But I think that the trend I see of most young people is that Islam is a modern thing, you know, possibly more connected with Turkey than other parts of the Islamic world. I don't know if that answered your question. But. Anyone else? I stunned you all with my presentation.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about the tensions between the Kyrgyz and the Uzbeks, also the tensions in Kyrgyzstan between the south people and the north people. Did you get any resonance of that?
You know, if you look at, let's see, let me go back to my slide. Oh, here. The Central Bazaar in Osh traditionally has had a lot of Uzbeks running the stalls and whatnot. And there were still plenty of Uzbeks there, but as you can see here, I mean, this is a bustling place, and this was probably, I believe the day it was its hot day, like Friday or something. I don't remember what day we were there, but this is pretty empty right here. I don't know if you can really tell from that picture, but there's obviously still tension there, or there would be more people, you know, back at their old place in the bazaar. So, you know, that's one of the very few visible signs of tension. It's hard to say because either people don't want to talk about it, or they just say, you know, who knows why this happened, and, you know.
What do they think about Bishkek?
In Bishkek?
Events in Bishkek.
Oh, events in Bishkek? You know what? They have a very c'est la vie attitude about it. I was actually, one of our drivers we hired was from Bishkek, and he was from Bishkek, and we were talking to him about the situation, and he was like, hey, man, we have a democracy here. We just, you know, there's just a change of government every, you know, 5 years through a revolution, so whatever. I don't know how serious he was, but most people, and Bishkek's a very interesting town. It reminds me of a very European city, very, very hip city with clubs and good restaurants, and I like Bishkek very much, the climate and just the town and the people, and I think they're too worried about, you know, living a prosperous life to get hung up on politics, but obviously some of them do, where there wouldn't be revolutions every 5 years. So it's an interesting place to be. Yes.
I don't know if you want to answer this, but I'm kind of curious how you with getting a degree in LCA. Is that right? Your PhD
yep.
in LCA and working for the Defense Department. I guess I just find it's kind of interesting.
Well,
how is that?
I'm a special case. I was here before, and when I left, basically Uli Shamloglu said, hey, you know, I know you're leaving because you want to take care of your family. You know, if you ever want to come back, you know, go ahead. So once I got through my degree there in D.C. and, you know, working with Dr. Burkhart, he said, you know, you really ought to go back and finish that degree at Madison. I'm like, yes, wouldn't that be great? Like, you know, who knows how long in the future. And then it just came about that, I brought it up to a few of my superiors and said, you know, I think this would be good for our office as well as for me. And they're like, hey, that would be. So essentially, if I would have said, hey, I want you to pay for an entire PhD program and 3 years of coursework or whatever it's going to be, 5 years, I mean, that wouldn't happen. But I'm like, I've already been there a couple years. I can go there and study, you know, Kazakh. And, you know, that's something I want to do anyway. And language proficiency is looked well upon DOD. So they said, sure, why not? Go ahead. And, you know, it took a lot of bureaucratic, you know, going through the wickets, but in the end of the day, I got to come back. So, I mean, really, it just happens that the things I'm studying, you know, fall into the column of filling out coursework for the PhD.
But is your work there related to this kind of cultural study
mm-hmm.
of Islam?
Sure.
I just find it interesting. I'm happy to hear that our Defense Department has such a broad
Sure. I mean, I've worked with people who actually studied with Uli at Columbia back in the foggy mist of time. And, you know, I know a guy who, you know, there's a lot. It's interesting. Maybe it's different for my area of the world because I think there were a lot of people back in the day who were Sovietologists of one stripe or another, you know. So they have a very broad view of you do language and literature, and, you know, there's a lot of Russian speakers and have all studied, you know, taken like Dostoevsky classes or something like that. So maybe it's a very different view. I don't know how other offices operate. And for example, if you're knowledgeable about Africa, if they're willing to send people here to do that, I don't know. But I think cultural knowledge is very highly prized in DOD, and And throughout the federal government, particularly since 9/11, it's been a very big push. We need more language proficiency, and we need more, at least from my point of view, I think they've been pushing for more language proficiency and cultural knowledge.
Other questions for Jack? Thank you for a very interesting presentation.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we told you we have several students.